This is Audible.
Belinda presents this unabridged recording of The Last Anniversary, written by Leanne Moriarty and read by Caroline Lee. Chapter 36. It's Sunday on Scribbly Gum Island. Rose sits on her back veranda with an old shoebox filled with photos on her lap. She can see the ferry, a speck in the distance, on its way over from Glass Bay, filled with visitors and their cameras and their picnic baskets and their shouting and their litter. And their purses and wallets, Connie would say. So stop your complaining. Rose picks a photo at random from the box. Connie and Jimmy on the dance floor on their wedding day. Enigma was flower girl, and Rose was bridesmaid. Jimmy is looking adoringly down at Connie's dark head. What would it have been like to have a man love you like that? Would it have changed something fundamental in your psyche to wake up each morning knowing that you were loved? That someone wanted to touch your body, even when it got all old and wrinkly? But the thought of a man touching her hand, her shoulder, her breast, as if they were all separate possessions of his, makes Rose want to gag. Move this way, move that way. Open your mouth. Lift your hips. She pushes the box off her lap so that some of the photos fall to the floor. A breeze snatches up the photo of Connie and Jimmy and twirls it whimsically away down towards the river. She lets it go. It seems nice to let them float away together on the breeze. She is going to make herself a nice cup of tea, but first, she will clean her teeth again to take away that unexpectedly nasty taste in her mouth. So much to do. So much to do. Margie slides her marble cake in the oven and tears her flowery apron over her head as she heads up the stairs to get dressed. She's on the roster to give the Alice and Jack tour this morning, and before that she has to pop around to Rose's place to drop off her prescription from the chemist. Also, she's going to have a chat with Rose about hiring a cleaner. A lovely girl called Kerry. She's Rotund Ron's daughter, and she's starting up her own business called Ms. Moppet's, and Margie wants to encourage her entrepreneurial spirit. Connie always disapproved of hiring cleaners, but Margie has had enough. Even her mother has started injecting an old lady tremor in her voice and innocently suggesting that Margie might like to help her out by just running the vacuum around for her. Kerry can come once a fortnight and do her house, Rose's house, and Enigma's house. They can afford it. She notices she flies up the stairs two at a time. When she walks now, her steps seem longer. She gets places faster. She pulls off her about-the-house dress and grabs that nice skirt from last winter. She zips it up, and it falls straight to the ground around her ankles. Goodness me! Dumbfounded, Margie stares at the skirt. She reaches down and pulls it up. Did she not zip it up properly? No, it's zipped all the way up. She lets go, and once again the skirt slides straight to her feet. It's far too big for her. Last winter, that skirt was too tight. She's going to have to take it in. Or, even better, give it away. Airily and generously. To somebody fatter than her. Light-headed with elation, she swings her new hips from side to side, and then she dances around her skirt, singing softly at first, and then louder and louder. Enigma is on her way out the door to go to a tennis club do. She and the girls kept playing tennis until well into their 60s, but then they decided it was getting too hard to hear what someone was saying if you were right down the other end of the court and trying to have a chat. So why not forget the tennis part and just go to interesting functions instead? Today they're seeing some woman speaking about her autobiography, which describes growing up on an Italian vineyard, or something foreign like that. It doesn't sound especially amusing to Enigma. Her own autobiography would be far more intriguing. She has made an appointment to have her hair done at the hairdresser's in Glass Bay beforehand, just in case the vineyard woman writer is really a cover-up. And Mike Munro is going to appear on the stage and say into the microphone, "Enigma McNab, this is your life," and shine the spotlight on her. For the last few years, she has been convinced she is going to be on This Is Your Life any day now. After all, she's the Munro baby. She's an Australian celebrity. It would make a very good, inspiring episode. There have been far less interesting celebrities on the show. It's getting a bit stressful, though, wondering when they'll surprise her and making sure she always looks her best. The phone rings, and she nearly doesn't bother answering it. But she does, just in case it's a journalist or something who wants to do a profile on her. It turns out that it's Veronica, who does want to write a book about the Munro baby mystery, but that's hardly the same thing as a journalist, because it's just Veronica. And also she's far too intent on actually solving the mystery, which is, of course, problematic. "I was just on my way out, pet," says Enigma impatiently. "Okay, Grandma, but can you just tell me when you're free so I can come over and hypnotize you?" asks Veronica. "I beg your pardon?" "Well, I realized the other day that it's very likely you have repressed traumatic memories, which could be brought to the surface under hypnosis. I could probably solve the Munro mystery just like that." There is a clicking sound, as if she has snapped her fingers. "Well, for heaven's sake." "I'm not going under hypnosis, thank you very much. I don't want to go under anything. I have high blood pressure. It could be extremely dangerous for my health. Anyway, what makes you think you can hypnotize me? What do you know about it?" "I've read up on it. It seems like a piece of cake to me. It's perfectly safe, Grandma, and who knows what could come out." "No, thank you very much indeed. I don't like the sound of that at all. And don't you secretly try to hypnotize me when I'm not looking, or I'll be very cross with you. I have to go now, Veronica. You can come and interview me with your tape recorder, but that's it." There is silence, and Enigma immediately gets suspicious. "You're not hypnotizing me now, are you?" "No, Grandma, I was just thinking." "Okay, don't worry, it doesn't matter. I've got another idea." Sophie has Grace, Callum, and the baby over to her new house for lunch on her balcony. She spent hours agonizing over what food to serve, looking through Connie's old recipe books, and finally just played it safe and bought some mushroom soup and crusty bread from the takeaway section of Connie's cafe. It's a beautiful day, and her guests seemed happy enough with their soup. Now she is serving them Belgian chocolate and Grand Marnier, her own area of expertise. "Do you believe in public or private education, Sophie?" asks Grace. Sophie has noticed Grace has the oddest habit of suddenly focusing her attention on Sophie and asking her opinion about a subject seemingly unrelated to anything they've been talking about. She listens carefully to Sophie's answer, but then doesn't seem to want to proffer her own opinion on the matter, changing the subject or immediately moving on to something new. It makes Sophie feel like she's attending an ongoing job interview. "Why is that on your mind? Are you thinking about enrolling Jake in school? Sophie tries to make it more like a normal conversation. Oh, I'm just interested in whether you have any philosophical views on the subject, says Grace. And Sophie notices Callum, who is holding Jake, giving his wife a gentle, puzzled look. Well, I guess it depends on the child, says Sophie. I think you should find the right school for your child's personality and ability, the one which will be the right environment for them. I think too many parents pick schools as if they're ordering a certain brand of child. Exactly, says Callum. That's exactly what I think. Some kids thrive in big, competitive schools with lots of activities, and others need a smaller, friendlier school with more one-on-one attention. They both look at Grace expectantly, but she doesn't say anything, just nods her head in a satisfied way and looks back out at the water. Sophie stands up to go and put the coffee on, and Callum's mobile phone begins to ring. Hello? Oh, right. Yeah. Hi. Just a sec. He hands the baby over to Sophie without asking and walks off to the other end of the veranda to take the call. It looks like a stressful phone call. Sophie watches Callum gesticulating. It's the builder, says Grace. I could tell by the way his voice dropped an octave when he took the call. The house is taking much longer than they promised. I hear they always do. Grace's thoughts appear to drift off. She is very difficult to talk to at times. Oh, look, Jake, says Sophie to the baby. Here's our kookaburra, arrived for a visit. He's got a friend with him, comments Grace. They watch the two kookaburras in silence for a few seconds. What are they doing? Sophie turns her head on one side. Are they fighting? Grace also turns her head on one side. Oh, says Sophie suddenly. Uh-huh, says Grace. The kookaburras are having furious, pornographic sex on the balcony railing. Sophie puts a hand over Jake's eyes, and Grace starts to giggle helplessly in a way Sophie has never heard before. It's contagious, and soon they are both laughing that silly, adolescent, stomach-hurting laughter you can only share with another girl. Sophie has always thought that the first time you get the hysterical giggles with a new female friend is like the first time you sleep with a boyfriend. It takes your relationship to a new, more intimate level. The two kookaburras are certainly taking their relationship to a new, more intimate level. Callum comes back from his phone call just as the male kookaburra finishes off with a violent thrust and flies off, leaving the female kookaburra looking ruffled and dazed. Talk about wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, says Sophie, which isn't funny at all, really, but is enough to set them off on a new wave of laughter. Grace puts her hands on her hips and bends forward to catch her breath, as if she's been running a race. Sophie's eyes stream as she hugs Jake to her. What? Callum raps his knuckles against the table with a sensible man expression. What's so funny? But that only makes them laugh even more. It's later that night. Callum is marking assignments and Grace is trying to settle the baby. But he's in a tetchy mood, and nothing she does pleases him. He keeps behaving like he's absolutely starved, sucking feverishly at the air, but then as soon as she gets him on her breast, he gives up after a few seconds, turning his head disgustedly, as if he hates her. He does hate her. She knows it. She's tried rocking him in a dozen different positions, bathing him, putting him in the stroller and pushing it up and down the hallway, giving him the dummy, taking the dummy away, closing the door and leaving him in his cot. But he just cries and cries. It's a pity, because on her way from Sophie's place this afternoon, Grace had felt almost normal for a few minutes. That silly, hysterical laugh over the kookaburras had somehow cleansed out her head, and when Callum put his hand on her shoulder, it felt comforting, not like a heavy weight. On the way home, she had decided to make salmon pasta for dinner, because she knew Callum would be starved after only having soup for lunch, and that felt like a good, definite, controllable decision. She knew exactly how she would make it, and she had all the ingredients. And maybe she'd have a glass of wine while she cooked. And maybe she didn't need to go ahead with the plan after all. Maybe it was going to be okay. Maybe that clamping sensation around her head was gone. But then, as they opened the front door, the baby started crying and hasn't let her be since. Callum said he didn't really feel like dinner anyway. He'd had enough to eat at Sophie's. Soup with a couple of bread rolls. He was in a bad mood because the builder had called with more problems, something to do with the bathroom tiles, and the budget isn't looking good. And he sat for ages reading the building contracts at the coffee table with his back hunched, chewing nervously on his bottom lip, while the baby cried and cried. Now Grace's thoughts are a tangled black mess again, and the clamping feeling is worse, more painful, because of the promise of relief earlier in the day. "Well, what do you want, then?" she hisses at the baby. "What? I'll do it!" Friends have told her that sometimes babies simply refuse to settle, and you just need to be calm and wait it out. But she didn't realize it would feel like he was doing it deliberately. She knows she is imagining that malicious satisfaction in his cry. She knows he is a baby, not a person. He is not making a conscious decision to do this. But it doesn't matter what she knows, because she believes in her heart that he is mocking her efforts. He doesn't like her, and she doesn't like him, and if he doesn't shut up soon, she might throw him against a wall. Hard. "Callum?" He comes out of the study immediately, looking startled. "What is it?" "I know you're working, but I just have to go for a walk. I'm really sorry, but I have to go for a walk right now." "Your son is not safe with me." "That's okay," he says soothingly. "Get some fresh air." He is a much better husband than she is a mother. She dumps the baby in his arms and virtually runs for the door. "You'd better put something warmer on," calls out Callum, but she pretends not to hear, and it takes a superhuman effort to close the door, not slam it. The cold air makes her eyes sting as she half walks, half runs down the steps, and out onto the paved footpath that circles the island. "It's like the yellow brick road," Rose always says. But didn't the yellow brick road go somewhere? Not just round and round in an endless, suffocating circle? I nearly did it. Grace trips and clumsily rights herself and keeps on walking, her arms swinging heavily, her legs stodgy. "Grace? Grace? What sort of name is that for someone like her?" She thinks of the way Callum automatically handed Jake over to Sophie when his phone rang today. They already looked like a family. "I nearly threw him." Chapter 37. Sophie must occupy the house. Sophie must repaint the house to suit her own tastes. Sophie must have Veronica over for dinner within a few weeks of moving in. "Cook my honey sage chicken for her, Sophie," page 46 of the Blue Book. She'll soon stop her sulking. Tell her she never liked my house much in the first place. Sophie must take her turn at the Alice and Jack tours. Grace must be responsible for Sophie's training. I thought I was a control freak, Ian, the sweet solicitor, had commented when he was explaining the terms of Aunt Connie's will to Sophie, before he'd asked her out and turned into a potential boyfriend. I don't mind any of the conditions, Sophie had said, although I don't know if Veronica will come to dinner. You know she wanted to contest the will. It's amazing that Connie could tell that was going to happen. Although, not so amazing, I guess. I think I've convinced her to drop that idea. There are no possible grounds. Anyway, Veronica, Thomas, and Grace all received substantial bequests from Connie. She was a very wealthy woman. I don't think you'll have any more problems with Veronica. He's right. When Sophie feels resilient enough to make the call, Veronica says, yes, she will come to dinner, in a tone of voice that suggests it's about time she was asked. You know what I read on my desk calendar yesterday? She asks Sophie. What? Sophie is cautious. Veronica sounds quite genial, almost whimsical, which is frankly terrifying. If you cannot get rid of the family skeleton, you may as well make it dance, quotes Veronica. George Bernard Shaw. I've decided it's time to make our family skeleton dance, and you're going to help me. Sophie speaks in a careful, neutral voice, as if she's negotiating the release of a hostage from a mad terrorist. Gosh, Veronica, that sounds intriguing. Yep, says Veronica. I don't suppose you need me to bring anything, do you? And obviously, I don't need your new address. I'll stay the night, shall I? Sophie recoils as if she's been shot in the stomach. She silently bangs her fist against her forehead and says, Of course, we can have breakfast together. Maybe, says Veronica in an if-you're-lucky tone. But I should see Mum and Enigma and Aunt Rose while I'm there on the island. And Grace and the baby, of course. Anyway, if I can fit in breakfast with you, I will. That's all I can ask, says Sophie faintly. Gotta run. See you next week, shouts Veronica, as if she's run off somewhere and is calling back over her shoulder. She slams down the phone. Making the family skeleton dance, thinks Sophie. Oh, dear, Veronica. Something tells me it's not meant to dance for you until your 40th birthday. Veronica brings a housewarming present when she comes to visit. It is a sculptured, abstract figure of a woman raising her hands in consternation, as if at some new puzzle of life. It's both beautiful and funny. Oh, Veronica, I just absolutely love it, says Sophie truthfully, feeling quite overwhelmed with gratitude in the circumstances. Of course you do. Veronica has a very bad cold. She sucks ferociously on a cough lolly. I knew you would. I bought it for you the same day I was really angry with you. Very expensive, too. That's the thing about you. You make people want to please you. It's not a compliment, by the way. No need to blush. I'm not blushing, says Sophie. Veronica is the only person Sophie knows who not only doesn't look away when Sophie blushes, but actually provides a running commentary on progress. Oh, look, it's reached your forehead. I wonder if your scalp blushes. So, you haven't changed the place much, I see. Veronica marches through the house like a nosy landlord, opening cupboards and drawers, even ripping back the shower curtain in the bathroom. Sophie trots behind her, full of pride and pleasure, as they enter each room. Are there any of Aunt Connie's old papers or anything still here? Asks Veronica suspiciously when they get to what used to be Connie's office. No, your mum cleaned out the whole place before I moved in. The house was sparkling. She's so lovely, Margie. And she works like a Trojan, doesn't she? Well, she obviously finds time to eat. She's lost 10 kilos so far at Weight Watchers. She's doing very well. I know she's going to Weight Watchers. You don't need to tell me about my own mother. It was my present to her for Christmas. I'm sick of hearing Dad tease her about her weight. He treats her like a dirty doormat, and she acts like one. It makes me sick watching them. I don't know what I'm going to do about that. Maybe losing weight will give her new confidence to stand up to your dad. I hope it gives her enough confidence to leave him. Really? Yes, really. Veronica puts on a prissy voice to mimic Sophie. We don't all have a fairy tale mummy and daddy like you. Oh, this was going to be such a fun night. My parents send their love, by the way. Are they proud of the way you got your hands on this house? Sophie breathes deeply. She is Audrey Hepburn in The Nun's Story. I hope you're hungry. I've cooked your Aunt Connie's recipe for honey sage chicken. I'm not actually that hungry. Veronica marches into the kitchen. She opens the oven door and peers inside. It looks ready to me. Don't overcook it. Her instructions were very firm about cooking for exactly 50 minutes, says Sophie. She had felt Aunt Connie's presence peering over her shoulder the whole time she was cooking. You've got to follow your own instincts when it comes to cooking, you know, Sophie. Veronica slams the oven door shut and sits down at the kitchen table. She taps her fingers rapidly. Did the recipe call for a spoonful of arsenic? Not that I noticed. Sophie rather desperately opens the fridge to look for the white wine she'd bought to go with the chicken. I wonder what poison she used to murder my great-grandparents. Sophie gapes at Veronica over the fridge door. You don't seriously think your Aunt Connie killed Alison Jack? She was only 19. Oh, 19-year-olds aren't capable of murder. Ha ha. Veronica gives Sophie the tired look of a hardened crime investigator who has seen many a brutal sight you couldn't even imagine, young lady. Sophie finds 2 wine glasses and pours their wine. All right, then. Well, what was her motive? It's rather enjoyable using words like motive in casual conversation. It makes her feel like one of those tough, resourceful forensic experts on TV shows like CSI. Sophie flicks her hair back, squares her shoulders, and sticks her breasts out. Those women always have very confident breasts. Veronica takes a gulp of her wine while still chewing on her cough lolly. Sophie winces. It's doubtful that the cough lolly is contributing much to the Chardonnay's buttery undertones. Well, obviously Connie was having an affair with Jack Munro, says Veronica. His wife had probably lost interest in sex, you see, after Enigma was born. Men always feel neglected after their wives have babies. Oh, I see, says Sophie. She wonders if Callum feels neglected. Just a little bit? She hopes so. Oh, stop it, you foolish, idiotic girl. You don't even mean it. Some crime scene investigator you are. Veronica continues with her explanation. So, Jack keeps promising Connie that he'll leave Alice, and he never does. You know, the way they always promise they'll leave their wives and they never do? So I've heard. Sophie feels suitably chastised. Connie finally realizes this. She goes mad with jealous rage, poisons them both, and helps herself to the baby. Why not just poison the baby, too? She wasn't a complete monster. And what happened to their bodies? chopped up, I expect. Veronica smacks her lips. Did you know that Rose and Connie's father was a butcher? Very handy for body removal. I don't know for sure, of course, but I wouldn't be surprised if the bones are buried in those big flower pots with the busy Lizzies all along Scribbly Street. And what about Rose? Asks Sophie. Was she in on it too? Accessory after the fact, pronounces Veronica. Helped with the cover-up. Sophie thinks about that day at Grace's house when Rose said, "We'll tell you the truth about what happened to Alice and Jack." It is extremely tempting to reveal this information to Veronica, just for the satisfaction of telling her something she doesn't know. But Sophie has never broken a promise, especially not one made to an old lady with fervently pleading eyes. It seems a bit odd to make a tourist attraction of the crime scene. Sophie raises a wry, detective-like eyebrow at Veronica. The woman had balls, agrees Veronica. Really? Sophie widens her eyes. Gosh, how did Jimmy feel about that? This isn't funny. She murdered my great-grandparents and she got away with it. She probably laughed all the way to her grave. Veronica blows her nose noisily, and Sophie feels remorseful, because if Aunt Connie did kill Alice and Jack, she'd find it more intriguing than dreadful. Murders that happened over 70 years ago don't seem quite as serious as murders that happen today. After all, the victims would be dead by now anyway, so the point seems sort of moot. But Veronica acts as if it all happened last week. Would you prefer a hot lemon drink to the wine? Sophie asks Veronica. No, snuffles Veronica. The wine is okay. Look, I want you to help me prove that Aunt Connie killed Alice and Jack. Then I'm going to write a book about it. I'll mention you in the acknowledgements, of course. You owe me. You wouldn't have got this house if it wasn't for me. But how could I help you? Sophie is aghast. It doesn't seem good etiquette to help prove someone a murderer after they've left you a house and a selection of potential new boyfriends. You can talk to my family, Rose and Enigma, even Mum and Dad, says Veronica. They're all hiding something. I know it. I've always known it. I used to hear comments all the time. Once, I overheard Mum and Dad fighting, and he said, I could blow this whole Alice and Jack thing sky high at any time. And Mum just laughed and said she didn't mind. It would be Aunt Connie he'd have to face. I confronted them, of course, and they just laughed at me. It happened when I was about 14. I keep forgetting about it for years at a time and then remembering and getting angry. It's a cover-up. My own family is involved in a cover-up, and I don't know the truth. Sophie thinks about how hurt Veronica would be if she knew what Enigma and Rose had said to her. Now Sophie is involved in the cover-up too, even though she has no idea of exactly what she's covering up. It's quite exciting. I really think you should ask them yourself. She tries to sound soothing and not patronizing. Oh, you think I haven't? Like a million times? My family likes you better than they like me. Veronica drains her wine glass and pushes it towards Sophie for a refill. Not one of them would back me up about Aunt Connie's will. They didn't want to help me contest it. They didn't want me to have the house. They wanted you to have it. They'd rather have you living here than me. I annoy them. I'm fundamentally annoying. Are we going to eat soon? Do you think you should check that chicken again? Veronica crunches her cough lolly between her teeth and looks meaningfully towards the oven. seemingly determined to prove that she is indeed fundamentally annoying. At that moment, the oven timer shrieks like a fire alarm, and they both jump. "I think Aunt Connie might be cross with us," jokes Sophie, a touch nervously, as she opens the oven for the chicken. Veronica shakes her fist at the ceiling. "I'm going to prove you did it, Aunt Connie. You always told me I needed to focus. Well, I'm focusing, all right? I'm focusing on you, murderer." Sophie puts the chicken on top of the stove, noting, hopefully, that it smells delicious, and watches Veronica curiously. "Are you okay? You look a bit pale. And you're acting even nuttier than usual."
"I guess I shouldn't be drinking when I'm taking antibiotics."
Veronica's words are softening at the edges.
"Also, I think I forgot to eat today. Oopsie."
And at that point, her eyelids droop and the top half of her body tips forward in slow motion until her forehead rests gently on the table. The next morning, Sophie leaves Veronica sleeping in Aunt Connie's spare bedroom. She is lying flat on her back, breathing snuffily through her mouth, one thin arm thrown dramatically across her eyes as if she can't bear the sight of something. It's strange to watch Veronica sleeping. She's so rarely quiet. Watching someone sleeping, thinks Sophie, is a bit like sneaking through their house when they're not home. Sophie notices for the first time that Veronica has elfin, pointy-tipped ears, and she feels a rush of motherly affection for her. So much so that she even considers tucking the blanket under Veronica's chin, except she doesn't want to risk waking her and feeling her affection evaporate. After stealthily leaving a cup of tea, a glass of water, and some Panadol next to Veronica's bed, she tiptoes out of the house. It's Sunday, and Sophie is meeting Grace for her first training session on the Alice and Jack tours. Sophie reaches the Alice and Jack house via the paved private footpath that snakes along the island shore. It still gives her a thrill to ignore the friendly but firm sign saying, "Sorry, only Scribbly Gum residents pass this point." The river is different every day. Today it's grey-blue and choppy, like someone vigorously shaking out a picnic rug. A huge pelican makes an ungainly landing on the rocks just beneath her.
"Good morning," calls out Sophie.
The pelican modestly lowers its swooping beak and shoots her a glinting glance from its mean, squidgy yellow eyes. As she rounds the corner, she sees Grace already waiting at the house. No baby. Callum must be minding him. Grace sits on the steps at the front of the house, wearing black jeans and a cream-coloured fleece, her hair scraped back from her forehead and tied in a single plait, looking like a supermodel in a perfume ad, but without a scrap of makeup. Each time Sophie sees Grace, it takes a few seconds to adjust to her beauty. It really is a bit much first thing in the morning. Sophie goes to wave, but then stops when she sees Grace's demeanor. She's sitting completely still, her hands resting limply on her knees, and the expression on her face is one of terrible desolation. Sophie feels a punch-in-the-stomach feeling of fear. She runs towards her. Something terrible must have happened. The baby? Callum? Grace? Her voice cracks. Is everything okay? But Grace looks up and smiles her gorgeous, glacial smile. Of course. Why? You looked so sad. Actually, you looked devastated. Grace stares at her with polite interest, and Sophie feels as if she's just said something embarrassingly indiscreet. I must have been deep in thought. Grace stands up, pulling on the knees of her jeans. I was trying to remember all the things I meant to tell you. Aunt Connie will be looking down at me saying ch-ch-ch if I get a word wrong. Oh, rubbish, thinks Sophie crossly. That was the saddest face I've ever seen. Who do these private people think they are? I wanted Margie to come and help me, continues Grace. She does most of the tours these days, but she was off to some Weight Watchers all-day meeting today.
All day? On a Sunday? Says Sophie.
Oh, dear. I was going to go around after this and let Margie know that Veronica is sick in bed at my place. I mean, Aunt Connie's place. She stops, feeling awkward about claiming ownership of Connie's house.
It's all right. It is your place now, not Aunt Connie's.
Grace gives Sophie a half glimmer of a smile. You should be the one looking devastated if you're nursing Veronica. Sophie laughs, somewhat overenthusiastically. She tries to encourage these moments when it seems Grace is relaxing enough to tease her. It gives her a glimpse of the friend she could be if she'd just loosen up a bit, like that day when they laughed at the kookaburras. Maybe they should get drunk together next and talk about sex.
Veronica is more manageable when she's not talking. Actually, last night she was talking about this book she wants to write. She has a theory that Aunt Connie killed Alice and Jack and hid their bodies. She thinks Connie was having an affair with Jack.
Grace doesn't look especially interested by this. Veronica has been coming up with new, more outlandish theories for what happened to Alice and Jack since we were children. I don't think it was anything as exciting as that. I think they just did a runner. They were behind on their rent. People were abandoning houses all the time during the Depression.
But what about the boiling kettle? The cake? All their clothes still in the cupboards? And why would they abandon their baby like that?
Grace shoves her hands in the pockets of her fleece and gives Sophie an odd, narrow-eyed look. Maybe it was a split-second decision. Maybe the baby was crying and crying and Alice couldn't stand it anymore. Maybe she thought she was going mad. Maybe she thought the baby would be better off with someone else. Maybe she just didn't like her baby.
Is she imagining it? Or is there a note of rising hysteria in Grace's voice?
Maybe, agrees Sophie gently.
This family? Was it in their genes? Something in the water? Inbreeding?
Surely Grace wasn't implying that she didn't really like her own beautiful, kissable, heart-melting little baby. Veronica is just so irritating sometimes. Grace brushes away an invisible insect. Aunt Connie always said it would be terrible for business if the Alice and Jack mystery was ever solved. She said the whole point of a mystery is that it's unsolved. So, look, shall we get started?
Sure.
Here's the script you'll have to learn off by heart. Aunt Connie didn't approve of reading from notes. I used to scribble cheat notes on my hands. She hands over a typed document, and Sophie reads, "Speak loudly, clearly, and dramatically. If anyone talks during your presentation, stop and look politely at them until they stop. Welcome to the home of my great-grandparents, Alice and Jack Munro. Open arms wide and smile." You'll have to take out all the references to great-grandparents, of course, says Grace, even though you're practically family now. Is that an edge to Grace's voice? Sophie looks up, but Grace just surveys her impassively. Sophie continues to read. Some of you may have heard of a famous mysterious ship called the Mary Celeste. You'll see the script makes a lot of comparisons to the Mary Celeste, comments Grace. It's like Scribbly Gum's sister mystery. I've got an old book of Aunt Connie's about the Mary Celeste if you'd like to read it. Anyway, come in. Grace turns and opens the door to the Alice and Jack house with a large, old-fashioned key, and Sophie feels a frisson of excitement. All the other times she's been in the house, she's been one of a shuffling, head-craning tour group. "Did Thomas ever give you a private tour of the house?" asks Grace as they enter the gloomy hallway. "No, he didn't even like coming to the island much. I could never understand it. It's so beautiful." "I think it's different when you grow up somewhere like this. It's like people who grow up in a small country town and want to escape to the big city. When I was 13, I wrote in my diary, 'This island is like jail,' and drew a very dramatic picture of me peering out from behind bars. Connie gave us each a boat, just a second-hand tinny, for our 16th birthdays, so then at least we could come and go as we pleased, more or less. But mostly we just imagined how great it would be to order pizza whenever you wanted, or go to the movies without travelling for 2 hours. I can remember seeing the three of you playing when I visited the island as a child," says Sophie. "Have I ever told you that? The last ferry was leaving and I looked back and saw you all playing some sort of game on the beach. I was so jealous. I thought you were like children living in a storybook." But Grace, in her disconcerting way, stops acting like a normal person and abruptly gets back to business. "Okay, rule number one. Keep an eye on your tour group at all times. We've had a lot of trouble with people trying to steal souvenirs. It's always the most unlikely people, too. Once, Veronica insisted this old lady empty her handbag, and she'd taken 2 lace doilies. She said they reminded her of her childhood home." "Oh, poor thing," says Sophie. "Rule number two. You probably know this from when you've done the tour yourself. Nobody except you goes into the corded off rooms. They have to stand in the doorway while you point things out. Some of them will beg you to let them in. I remember one man even offered Thomas a bribe. He told me about that. He was horrified, of course. Yes, he's always been a good boy. If it was Grandma Enigma taking the tour, she'd probably have negotiated for more." Grace unhooks the red cord from the doorway of the kitchen and gestures for Sophie to go ahead of her. "Now, for a proper Aunt Connie authorized tour, you should really come in early and light the fuel stove, and then just before the tour starts, you put the kettle on." She gestures at the large copper kettle sitting on top of the squat fuel stove. "That way, as you're leading the group down the hallway, the kettle can actually be whistling while you're saying, 'As sisters Connie and Rose walked down the hallway, they could hear the sound of the kettle boiling and smell a freshly baked cake.' Nothing seemed amiss. But to be honest, I think Margie is the only one who still bothers with actually boiling the kettle these days. The one thing you do have to remember is to cook the marble cake. The brochure says it's made to the original recipe, but I'm afraid that's slightly misleading. Well, completely misleading. We all have our own versions. I'll give you my recipe." "Oh, I'm sure I could find a good packet mix for marble cake," says Sophie. Grace laughs politely as if she's making a joke, and Sophie thinks, oh dear. She tiptoes reverently across the brown lino floor of the kitchen. "It gives me goosebumps with just us being in here. Probably because it's freezing." Grace bounces up and down on the balls of her feet, her hands tucked into her armpits. "So, when you're describing the kitchen, you leave the chair and the bloodstains until last. Explain how Alice had to cope without running water or electricity or food processors or microwaves. No fridge. They didn't even have an ice box. There's something called a drip safe out on the veranda. If you've got any women over 70 in your group, expect lots of interruptions. They'll want to tell you about how their lives during the Depression were even harder than Alice's. It's a mistake to look in the slightest bit interested. They'll never shut up. Aunt Connie used to say, "You must tell me about that after the tour." By the way, make sure you don't touch anything while you're walking around the kitchen. People take the "nothing has been touched" line very seriously. "Nothing has been touched, has it?" asks Sophie, who is one of those people. Margie does the dusting and she's very careful. But Enigma is picking up things all the time. And once Veronica was doing the tour and she tripped over the upturned chair and knocked the crossword and pen flying. So I'd say the crime scene has been pretty well contaminated. Sophie looks closely at the crossword sitting on the scrubbed kitchen table. The page from the newspaper is folded into a square and a big pen is sitting on the paper. Whoever was doing the crossword was halfway through writing out the word "brilliant" in three across. I wonder if it was Alice or Jack doing the crossword. Jack, I would think, while poor Alice was slaving away baking the cake. It looks like a woman's handwriting to me. Does it? Grace makes a non-committal sound and continues on with her instructions. So, once you've painted a picture of domestic bliss, you point out the chair and the bloodstains. Somebody will ask you how you can be sure they're bloodstains. Just give them a frosty look and say, "We can't be sure. We can't be sure about anything in this house, except that it's a mystery." Sophie crouches down to examine the trail of brownish stains leading from the back door to the chair. It doesn't look like enough blood for somebody to die. "I'm quite sure Aunt Connie didn't kill anybody," says Grace. "Veronica just can't forgive her for leaving her house to you. Shall we do the bedroom next?" The bedroom is tiny, almost filled by a double bed with a pale pink eiderdown. Next to the bed is a washstand with a basin and jug and, of course, the crib. "Make sure you point out the indentation in the pillow where the baby's head was," says Grace. "They love that." Sophie peers in the crib. "Actually, I can't see it." Grace puts her hand in the crib and smooths out a hollow in the shape of a baby's head. "There you go." Sophie shakes her head and laughs. "You're starting to spoil the magic. Aunt Margie washes the linen every month." "Oh." Sophie pauses. "I wonder how your grandma Enigma feels when she sees this crib," she says to Grace. "Her parents obviously cared for her, and she never knew them, or even knew what happened to them." "Oh, she sometimes pretends to get all sentimental about it, but really she loves being the Alice and Jack baby. Wait till you see her swanning around at the anniversary next month." Maybe, deep, deep down in her subconscious, she's still yearning for her real mother, says Sophie. They say babies can recognize their mother's voice by the time they're born. "Babies don't care who looks after them, as long as they're fed and clean." "You don't think Jake would miss you if you disappeared?"
"He wouldn't miss me in the slightest."
"Oh, of course he would."
"He wouldn't. He'd grow up and he wouldn't remember a thing about me."
"Well, maybe not consciously."
"So do you think adopted children are all subconsciously yearning for their real mothers?"
Grace looks far too involved in this conversation. It's so strange the way one minute she's distant and the next she's practically interrogating Sophie. Oh, God, was Grace adopted? Has Sophie insulted her by implying she is psychologically damaged? No, I didn't mean that. I don't know what I meant. I don't really know anything about babies.
Grace tucks in a corner of the mattress in the crib and doesn't look at Sophie.
Would you like to have one?
Gosh, here comes the job interview again.
Yes, very much, but I can't seem to find a man to have one with, and my biological clock is ticking very nervously. I'm 39. I might have to accept I'm probably going to miss the baby boat.
Blab, blab. Reveal your deepest fears, why don't you?
And meanwhile, Grace won't even tell you how she feels about the weather.
But you must have lots of men interested in you.
Well, thank you, but no, not really.
Your husband's hand brushed against mine the other night. Does that count?
I seem to have been going through a very long dating dry spell. Although, of course, I told you, I've been asked on dates by two separate men in the last few weeks.
Grace looks at her sharply, almost angrily. You didn't tell me that.
Didn't I? I know I told Callum. You mustn't have been there.
She waits for Grace to do the obligatory flutter of female excitement, but she just looks irritated.
Are you interested in either of them?
It's too early to tell.
Well, that's just great.
I'm sorry?
Sophie stares in bewilderment at Grace, who has begun massaging her forehead with her fingertips.
What's just great?
Grace looks up. Sorry, I keep getting these horrendous headaches, and I can feel another one coming on. Do you mind if we finish this another day?
Of course not. You poor thing, you must get home and lie down.
As they are locking up the house, Grace says urgently, I'll talk to you soon.
Okay?
Sophie watches Grace walk off down the hill, her hands jammed in the pockets of her fleece, her shoulders slumped.
It must be a very bad headache.
Why didn't you tell me that Sophie has two men after her?
Callum glances briefly up at Grace from his newspaper with unfocused eyes, all his attention still on whatever he's been reading.
I don't know. I guess I thought you already knew.
I didn't.
Well, now you do.
He's reading again. Grace feels a surge of teeth-grinding irritation. This stupid man is going to let her slip through his fingers.
I don't think either of them is very well suited to her, she says.
Actually, I think you'd be a better match.
Callum chuckles and turns the page of his paper.
Pity for her, I'm taken.
Grace digs her nails into the palms of her hands. This isn't working. He doesn't even sound that interested. She's going to have to plant the idea in his mind.
Actually, I think she really likes you.
As a friend?
No, she likes you. I've seen the way she looks at you.
Callum looks up properly now.
What is this? You're not seriously worried about Sophie, are you?
Retreat, retreat. He's so bloody principled. If she acts jealous, he won't have anything more to do with Sophie. She just needs him to feel flattered.
Of course not. I'm just saying that if you were single, I think she'd be after you.
Well, I'm not single, and I don't want to be single ever again, thanks. I hated being single.
The expression on his face is so guileless and genuine that Grace has to look away, embarrassed by his naked, sooky niceness. He says, Are you okay, honey? Is everything okay? You don't seem yourself.
No, you just don't want this to be myself.
I beg your pardon?
This is myself. You've always had some idea of me that doesn't exist.
As she says this, she feels that it is in fact true. He has refused to see her true ugliness. It's exhausting and not very fair having to pretend all the time. Callum carefully folds the newspaper and runs his thumb along the crease. What do you mean, Grace?
You just see what you want to see.
She lets her cheeks and her mouth be dragged downwards into the face of a sad clown. Let him see.
I don't know what you're accusing me of. I don't even know what we're talking about.
There is just the slightest tremor in his voice.
You don't know me.
Oh, for Christ's sake, Grace, you're my wife. You're the mother of my child.
No need to get dramatic. You said I don't seem myself, and I'm telling you, this is myself. Take it or leave it.
He flinches as if she slapped him. His eyes are watery and frightened. Grace leaves the room, her legs trembling. Chapter 38. Join us for a night of intrigue and illumination. The anniversary of the mysterious disappearance of Alice and Jack Munro in 1932 is one of the most exciting events on the Scribbly Gum Island calendar. It's the one night of the year when non-island residents are allowed to stay on the island after sunset. The main street of the island is lined with food stalls, lit by hundreds of glittering fairy lights and warmed by giant heaters. But please do rug up, as it can be chilly. The theme of the night is mystery. There will be mystery lucky dips, mystery prizes, and mysterious entertainment, such as magicians, dancers, fire breathers, and tarot card readers. Meet some of the people involved in the Alice and Jack mystery, like Rose Doughty, one of the two sisters who first discovered the abandoned home, and Enigma McNab, the baby, now a grandma, who was found in such mysterious circumstances. Free face painting for every guest. Hurry, limited tickets available, only $75, including GST, ahead. Special note, the island gets very cold at this time of year. We recommend warm woolly hats covering your ears and gloves and scarves. Please take care to dress your littlies very warmly.
What do you mean you can't make it? What sort of talk is that?
I just can't make it this year.
I feel jolly well offended you'd even suggest such a thing.
Oh, Mum, please, there's no need to be.
Some sort of Weight Watchers party, did you say?
Not exactly. It's more of a function, I guess you'd call it.
Wouldn't be much of a party, would it? Everyone standing around chomping on celery sticks, looking miserable and skinny. I know where I'd rather be.
It's not really anything to do with Weight Watchers. It's just somebody from Weight Watchers has asked me to go to this thing.
And you said yes. To this thing. You actually said yes. You can't just not be here. You've always been here for the anniversary, every year of your entire life.
Enigma is utterly baffled. She can't believe that Margie is being so uncharacteristically willful. Laura was the naughty one. Margie was a good, pliable girl, which seemed only fair, what with all the problems that Laura caused. And now here Margie is at the age of 55 saying she can't make it to the anniversary and pressing her lips together as if that